Good morning. The sole case for oral argument this morning is Mark and Bonnie Davis, appellants, et al., versus the State of South Dakota, defendants and appellees, et al. For the appellants, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, Jr., Mr. Scott Abdullah, and Ms. Pam Bolwig from Sioux Falls. Mr. Parsons, I understand you'll be presenting this morning. Very well. And for the appellee State of South Dakota, we have Attorney General Marty Jackley, Assistant Attorney Generals Diane Best and Bobby Rink. I understand Ms. Best will be presenting this morning. Very well. Due to the nature of the case, the court has granted extended argument time. Ordinarily, we allow 50 minutes. We've, in essence, doubled that. And in order to avoid turning this into an endurance contest, the court has determined that we will take a 10-minute break. Mr. Parsons will speak for the first 45 minutes, then the 10-minute break. Then Ms. Best will respond for 45 minutes, and then Mr. Parsons has the rebuttal, 15 minutes, I believe. Any questions from counsel before we proceed? All right. If not, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 45 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Attorney General Jackley and Assistant AGs Best and Rank. The great conservative commentator George Will had a column in the Washington Post about a month ago in which he discussed a decision by the Texas Supreme Court that placed a check on the exercise of power by the Texas legislature because it violated the Texas state constitution. And the question there was whether the court should simply defer to the legislature's judgment about it was and was not permitted to do, or did the court have an obligation to ensure that the state constitution was being followed and enforced? In other words, the question was, when does judicial deference to legislative majorities become a dereliction of judicial duty to enforce the limits and requirements of the Constitution? And as Will put it, there comes a constitutional tipping point at which excessive deference to a legislature in the face of a constitutional limitation or command becomes an abandonment of duty. And he made a very eloquent distinction between an activist judiciary, which critics would say creates rights that are not specified in the Constitution or implied, and an engaged judiciary, which defends constitutional rights that the framers actually placed in our Constitution and prevents the elective branches from violating the separation of powers by usurping the judiciary's duty to declare what the Constitution means. Just this past Friday, Charles Krauthammer had a column in which he discussed a renewed constitutionalism that is taking root in our public discourse and a consciousness that is awakening on all sides of the political spectrum in which citizens are looking back to the great first principles that are embraced and protected in our fundamental charters and are seeking to breathe life back into our constitutional text. The federal constitution, and here in South Dakota, our state constitution, defines concretely the nature of our social compact, and nothing in our public life is more substantive or politically sacred. And just this week, the U.S. House of Representatives convened and began its new session with a reading of the United States Constitution. And if the South Dakota legislature, on this great first day, began its work with a reading of the South Dakota Constitution, it would find that a substantial portion of that recital would deal with the subject of education more than any other constitutional right.
Well, you know, there's a fine line between what you'd call constitutional cowardness and overreaching. And the federal constitution is a grant of limited powers to Congress. We have interpreted the South Dakota constitution to be a limit only on the powers of the legislature. Is that a distinction with a difference here today?
It's a completely accurate distinction. And I'm not suggesting cowardice at all. I'm suggesting that deference in the face of a violation of the Constitution is itself a violation of the separation of powers. If you examine the South Dakota Constitution, well, first let me give you a roadmap of where I thought our discussion would go today. I'm at, of course, your service, but what I thought I would do would be to first talk a little bit about the constitutional history and text of Article 8, which is our education article, and what it means. And then I wanted to move into how the provisions of Article 8 we believe are being violated and detail the substantive and sustained and systematic failure of our funding system and what we believe is the resulting denial of education rights to a substantial segment of our student population. And then finally, I wanted to talk about what we are asking this court to do. So I guess I'll begin with constitutional history. And as you could probably tell from my brief, I love the historical aspect of constitutional law. Constitutional questions are always controlled by the text itself. But the history and the motivations behind the choice of particular constitutional language quickens the analysis. And I think here our constitutional history really underscores two primary motivations in enacting Article 8 of our Constitution. Our founding fathers understood that education was one of the most, if not the most, fundamental functions of state government, as this court itself recognized in Olson versus Wyndham. And this is so because the fabric of society and the stability of free government depends upon an educated populace. In 1862, our first territorial governor, William Jayne, said that every dollar of taxes levied for the support of schools lessens by many dollars the taxes which would be assessed for the support of prisons and poorhouses. And the record in this case supports that conclusion as well. It's a timeless truth. And the second thing I think that the constitutional history really underscores is that our founding fathers were particularly obsessed with ensuring that education in South Dakota would always be suitably funded so that all of its advantages and opportunities were available to all of its citizens throughout the state. And it's tragically ironic, I think, that South Dakota was at its founding considered to be a leader in the constitutional protection of sufficient funding for education. General Beadle, who drafted our education article, was meeting with presidents about the issue. And his ideas are considered the basis for the educational mandate that was found in the Enabling Act that granted us statehood and were studied by subsequent states in their constitutional conventions in drafting their own education clauses. And now,
how much of the funding was actually set up to be funded by the state legislature as opposed to local property taxes?
Well, originally there was established a fund that was created with the sale of school lands.
School lands. Other than that, was there any other state general funds that went into schools?
There were some other, I think, general funds created by the Constitution for the result of certain costs, certain revenue that would come into the state. But Article 15 is very clear that it says that the legislature was required to make such provision, whether by general taxation or authorizing schools to raise their own revenue, combined with the general fund, the school fund, as to secure a thorough and efficient system of schools.
Mr. Parsons, I like to poke around in history books, too, and one thing I couldn't find is even though Article 8 authorized the state to assist in education through the general fund, it didn't appear they did so in the early years. At least I couldn't find it. Do you know what year they actually start making regular payments to the school districts to assist?
I don't know the year, but I think it was in the early 20th century. The school fund, from what I could tell, was more than sufficient. It was well endowed and well managed for many, many years.
In other words, they were making enough money off selling the $10 an acre land that the state didn't need to supplement it.
That's right, and the investments that came from investing that fund, the revenue.
So sometime 1910 or that, they have to supplement it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's my understanding. And because eventually, you know, there was a massive influx of population, and the settlers who came here began to have children, and we began to spread out to all parts of the state, and communities began to grow, and so the needs grew. Now, after that incredible history and the incredible founding we were given, South Dakota is now 51st in the nation, dead last in state aid to education.
Before you go beyond that, before you get beyond history, how does the obligation of the local school districts fit into this equation? Because the Constitution specifically imposes the duty on them as well. And so doesn't that present some difficulty for your case to, because you're putting the entire onus on the state, and there is some constitutional responsibility with the local districts.
School districts have a constitutional role to play in providing an education. The mandate in Article 8, I would suggest, is upon the legislature to make such provision, either by general taxation or authorizing the school districts to raise their own revenue, as to secure a thorough and efficient system of education. And so if the state is tying the school district's hands, as the record, I think, at trial demonstrated, then the school districts are unable to perform its their constitutional mandate of providing the education. And so we all believe in the essence of, in the concept of local control. But ultimately, the state has the responsibility under the Constitution, the legislature in particular, to ensure that the provision is made, that enough resources are made.
And that cap came into effect, remind me, what year was that?
Well, the...
In the 70s?
Yeah, in the 70s, and the system, of course, changed in the under the Janklow administration when we went to a per-pupil basis. And that scrambled the entire system because the economies of scale between the Sioux Falls School District and the Faith School District or the Bonham School District are so disparate, are so incredibly different, that to allocate the same amount per pupil for both of those districts ignores economic reality. Now, there is an adjustment for sparsity, but I think the record demonstrated that's just another, you know, a few hundred dollars more for per pupil, and it bears no reflection, no conceivable demonstrable relation to the actual cost it takes for those districts to educate kids.
The provision that put the cap in, if that were removed, would that adjust the formula enough to meet your requests?
It's quite possible. I mean, that's quite possible. That's relief that could ultimately be granted would be striking down of certain limitations on school districts and what they can spend.
I guess, Mr. Parsons, if I can paraphrase, are you saying that by putting the limitations have been put on the local districts, that they are, in essence, the legislature has increased its own constitutional responsibility because they're limiting local districts? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think it's increased its constitutional responsibility. I think it has violated its constitutional responsibility if the effect of that is to make school districts, some school districts, not able to meet their obligation to educate these kids, which is ultimately the state's obligation.
This is obviously outside the record, but you're asking us to, in some manner, if you get relief, to supervise the education system of the state. It is no secret that there are current discussions going on about the possibility of budget cuts. If the legislature opts to go in that direction, how does that affect your argument before this court today?
I don't think that it is this court's job to supervise education, and that's never what we've claimed. We're asking this court to tell us what the Constitution means, tell us what the Constitution requires, examine the record, and declare that the Constitution is not being met, and then instruct the legislature to come up with its own remedy. We've conceded from the very beginning, from the drafting of the complaint, that the legislature is only empowered to appropriate funds, to pass legislation, We're not asking this court to craft a specific remedy in terms of a solution at this point, certainly. We might, eventually, it's possible the court could strike down certain legislation. That's a possible remedy. But at this point, we're asking for declaratory relief, and that's essentially all we're asking for, is declaratory relief.
So at this point, you're only asking for money. You haven't asked us to strike down the cap. You haven't asked for anything really other than more money, correct?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. We have not asked for more money.
Well, but that's your evidence at trial is that there's not enough money to constitutionally provide an adequate education.
That's true. There are not enough resources in many districts. They are prevented from providing an adequate education. The solution, we believe, is more resources, but it could be a reorganization of resources. We're not asking this court to order that additional money be spent, although that's certainly a possible remedy that the legislature could choose.
So you're asking us to simply go up to the line and say, current system is not adequate. Now, legislature, it's your option, constitutional prerogative, to figure out how to fix that.
That's right.
Well, and what evidentiary basis did you establish at trial for the level at which the system would become constitutional? What monetary, what PSA, or what general appropriation does the evidence in this case show is necessary to make the system constitutional?
There is not evidence that suggests a specific dollar amount needs to be spent to correct the problem. What the evidence at trial suggested, and I think proved overwhelmingly, was that our rural districts in particular, and our districts with at-risk kids, and our districts with Native American populations, are now unable, under the present system, to provide a sound and basic education, the bare minimum, and to meet what we suggest is the constitutional standard.
Yet some of those areas are actually highly funded compared to others.
Some areas are. That's true. And that's but that doesn't mean they're adequately funded. The state's own experts at trial admitted that it varies greatly from district to district on overall cost.
It's not equal protection.
It's not equal protection. It's that everyone has to be brought up to a minimum level. Let's talk, if I could just briefly get into the constitutional text, and then
before you do that, I want to follow up on my prior question. If there isn't evidence in the record to tell the legislature what the minimum level of money is necessary to make it constitutional, what constitutional yardstick are they to use to make the decision? And are we to wait, if we're to declare this unconstitutional, are we to wait until the plaintiffs decide that it's not constitutional and bring another lawsuit to determine whether we've reached that point? I mean, how do both this court and the legislature know what to do? What level of money is necessary?
Well, it's always a political question when you're talking about the appropriation of specific funds. And what the legislature is to do, I think one thing that it could do and should do and has never done, is figure out what it actually costs to educate kids. And we've never had that type of examination in the South Dakota legislature. What this court should order the court to do is, based on the text of the Constitution, which says that there is a duty of the legislature to establish and maintain a general and uniform system of education, and to adopt all suitable means to secure to the people the advantages and opportunities of education, and then to make sufficient provision to secure a thorough and efficient system of common schools. This means that there must be provision so that schools can meet the basic advantages of what an education is, and that's what I think this court and other courts throughout the country have established as a constitutional standard.
Are there school districts in South Dakota that are receiving adequate funding?
I think there probably are. I think, no one's suggesting that kids who go to school in Sioux Falls aren't getting a pretty good education. And they drive our numbers up. But, you know, the constitutional education rights don't end at the Minnehaha County line. It's these rural communities, these sparsely populated communities that are just not surviving.
Some of the cases that you cite from other jurisdictions have a remedy where they say that certain school districts in the state are not receiving funding, and therefore, as to those particular school districts, the Constitution is being violated. You're not asking that for South Dakota, though. You're saying even though there are some school districts, who knows, maybe a majority, I don't know, that are adequately funded, you're still asking us to say that the entire state's funding system is unconstitutional. Why not do a more surgical approach and deal with those school districts alone that are not getting adequate funding?
I think the legislature could come up with a surgical remedy, but I think the fact that we have vast segments of our population that aren't receiving an adequate education, that can't make ends meet, that's reflective of a sustained and systematic problem. That means the system is broken.
Does your evidentiary record give us any kind of a percentage as to how many, what percentage are getting an adequate education and what aren't?
Yes, yes. The way that this was tried is we follow the model that's been done in many states was by looking at focus districts. And so each side selected districts that we believe shined a spotlight and were typical in the problems. One was the Faith School District. And you look at the Faith School District, it's a rural area. It's 864 square miles. There's almost no property value. Consolidation is not an option, and the district is broke. It's been bankrupt. It tries to enact opt-outs, and most fail. They tax at the maximum allowable level. They've cut so much in this district that it's hard to even recognize that there's still a school there. I mean, they've cut industrial arts, family consumer science, foreign language teacher, the library, business courses, accounting, business math, economics, multiple administrative positions. There's no bus service. Textbooks are 15 years old. There's no agricultural ranch program in an ag district. Students can't qualify for the opportunity scholarship. There's no art teacher, no curriculum director, no drama, no debate, no one-act play, no science fairs. Math only goes up to pre-calculus. There's no gifted program. There's no advanced chemistry. There's no ACT or college preparatory curriculum like Sioux Falls students get. There's no newspaper, no wrestling, no counselor that's full-time. The superintendent is the high school principal, the superintendent, the federal programs director, the truancy officer, and the curriculum coordinator. And he says, we're not providing our kids with an adequate education. We can't prepare them for college adequately.
How many students are in Faith?
I believe it's about 200.
Total, K through 12?
I believe so.
All right, Mr. Parsons, and we've cut off on, and you indicated that this is different than Sioux Falls, but you indicated earlier you're not addressing this as an equal protection argument. So do we really have to look at what numbers aren't meeting the basic standard? You're just saying that, as I understand it, that the basic standard for education, whatever that is, if it's VOAG or drama or whatever, I don't know that we're going to get there, but that a basic standard isn't being met in some number of districts. Do we have to get to equal protection then?
No, and we're not making an equal protection argument. We're saying that in large segments of the state, the constitutional floor is not even being approached, and that's why there's a systematic violation. I mean, we don't have to wait until no students are getting an adequate education before we declare a systematic violation. I mean, you can't wait until the patient is dead before you declare an emergency and start to seek medical care.
But isn't that the problem that the court has? Is what is that level? What percentage is the level that it finally becomes unconstitutional?
And what
it doesn't have to get to zero. Not, but then is 50% good enough? Is 75%? You know, what I think that's the problem that the courts have is that we are not equipped to make those kinds of decisions.
But And the way courts have dealt with this is they said what you need is a sustained and systematic problem. When you have a system of have-nots and haves, and when large parts of the state, now I'm not saying if one kid is not getting an adequate education, there's a constitutional violation. But what we think that we've demonstrated with through all the focus districts, from Faith, Bonham, Willow Lake, Rapid City, these districts, large segments of rural communities and at-risk kids are simply being lost. We're losing the kids. They can't be taught. They're not ready for college. They're not ready to work.
Did the trial court find in your favor on the findings as to the large segments not getting adequate education?
I don't think so. The trial court cited evidence that favored the state, and it did not cite evidence that favored the plaintiffs. It found that none of the school superintendents that testified in any of the focus districts were credible at all, but only the state's experts were credible. These types of blanket credibility findings, I think, are meant to prevent effective appellate review, but I know this court is going to look at this with fresh eyes.
But, you know, I didn't see in your brief all 140, was it, or pages, where you made a real argument about clearly erroneous findings.
Well, we did mention what I believe several main ones, and of course we you know, filed all of our objections to each. You know, there are hundreds and hundreds of findings. So we made more general arguments, but really the facts are not disputed. I mean, no one came in and contested what the actual conditions in these districts are. What the trial court did was come to different conclusions about those facts and what they signified and did not signify than we did, and that's, of course, something that this court reviews de novo.
What about the experts, though, that actually went to these districts and some of them came back and testified that it wasn't as you portrayed it in those districts?
I don't think there was much. I can't recall any disputing of a historical fact. Now, they came to different conclusions. They said, well, I think this is a perfectly fine education. I think this is a perfectly fine, building or facility. I think it's fine to teach kids in trailer homes, broken-down trailer homes, in the shadow of a condemned school building that's been sitting there for coming up on a decade because the school can't afford to fix it or build a new one, can't even afford to knock it down. That's in Faith. Kids are taught in trailer homes that are 20 by 20 approximately, and every time you open the door, the snow blows in. Kids wear their coats during class in the winter. To go to the bathroom, if a kid wants to get up and go to the bathroom, the whole class hears him. And these kids in Faith are called trailer trash by other kids. It was meant as a temporary fix when the school building was condemned, but there's no possible way for them to fix it because there's no resources. That's not providing these kids with a constitutionally adequate education. And it shows. I mean, that's the thing. We have the hard numbers that are also cannot be disputed.
So it's obviously, though, a rolling measure. I mean, I don't mean to make light of your argument, but, I mean, you're talking to some of us who went to a one-room schoolhouse and we didn't even have indoor plumbing. Obviously, that was okay in the 40s and 50s. How do you judge that as it goes along? And even the one-room schoolhouses is what the founders would have been looking at as an adequate education, and to the eighth grade, maybe. Yeah. So how does the court determine, how does that measure roll as time progresses?
Well, standards obviously have changed. What was cruel and unusual punishment when we drafted the Constitution, whipping was not. Now you can't whip prisoners. But, what you really should look at, I think, is the effects of what is happening. Because I think back then, in order to participate in society, most of these kids were just going to take over the farm, and they needed only an eighth grade education. They needed, only to learn their letters and be able to add up a few numbers for a bill. That doesn't cut it in today's society. I mean, that absolutely we're not preparing kids, and what is reflected in the numbers, I mean the hard numbers. Right now, 1 out of 4 kids in South Dakota is not proficient in basic math. And 1 out of 4 kids in South Dakota is not proficient in reading. It was 20% at the time of trial. Now it's 25. That's all, of course, court could take judicial notice. It's all on the Department of Education website.
Is there also evidence, though, that they are that there are things in place with the Department of Education to raise that standard and require these school districts to raise that standard?
There's our statutes that require them to. I mean, they're required.
That's not enough?
No, because there are statutes that require them to make annual, yearly progress to try to correct these numbers, but they're not given the ability to do so in these rural and focused districts. And these numbers are averages. When you look at the focus districts where the conditions are so bad, in Faith and Doland and White Lake and Bonham, there it's 50%, I think, in Faith. They're not proficient in reading and math. In Doland, I believe it's 2/3 of the people who graduate not proficient in basic reading and math. Another, 10% drop out and fail to graduate. So there are massive segments of these areas in the state and parts of our population, at-risk kids, who aren't being given the chance to succeed.
I remember hearing a speech, I think it was by Governor Janklow, that he said that there wasn't one school district in South Dakota that had more first graders than seniors. And that I know the state argues that the census of students is going down. They're saying their contribution level is going up. Is there a ceiling at some point where that's all we can afford?
In practice, economics, when the legislature is crafting a remedy, economics have to go into the analysis. But under the Constitution, you can't just say, all right, kids, West River, there's not enough of you. I'm sorry, you don't get the chance to get an education. No, the Constitution, we can't allow that. We have to come up with some solution. I mean, we can't just herd everyone into certain counties. I mean, the people who operate our farms need to be able to send their kids to schools that will give them a chance to succeed.
Did you offer such a solution to the trial court?
Well, there were many solutions presented, and many of them by the state. I mean, one of the state's experts said, hey, I could fix this in 2 years. Give me 2 years, I could fix the whole thing. Why aren't they doing it? I mean, it's undeniable that these kids aren't given the tools to succeed. I mean, the statistics reflect that. South Dakota is third to last in the nation in students who, in their first year of college, can't even make it to their second year of college. And I think something less than half of our kids who enter a four-year university graduate. And more than a third require remedial reading and math in college. And most of them are from rural districts and districts that aren't being given these resources. The state's own experts said, and the Board of Regents, Paul Terman from the Board of Regents admitted at trial, I thought this was some of the most critical testimony in the entire trial. He said that preparation for success in college requires, it's an absolute requirement, the completion of a rigorous academic curriculum. It's called a college preparatory curriculum. And kids in Sioux Falls get it, and kids in Aberdeen get it, and kids in Pierre probably get it. Kids in these other districts that aren't the fortunate ones, they don't get it. They get no advanced classes, no college preparatory classes. And that shows. When they get to college, they flunk out. And that's, the statistics don't lie. So there is a sustained and systematic problem that this court can address. I thought at trial, really, the best witnesses that made the most critical points were connected to the state of South Dakota. All of the state's witnesses admitted that the critical factor is a good teacher for a successful student. It's the most critical thing. I mean, that's common sense. We all know that. But South Dakota, in these rural districts, these school districts are now unable, according to our own statistics, to attract and recruit teachers to teach in these rural areas because the pay is so abysmal. They put out applications for jobs and they get one or two applicants and they're not qualified. We're hiring teachers in South Dakota by necessity that other states would not allow to teach. The testimony was our cut scores are so much lower than other states on the praxis tests for allowing certification that in some points 30% lower, 50% lower than other states and surrounding states. Teachers who can't get a job in other states can come to South Dakota and teach. And the pay is so low, they're not getting any applicants in many of these districts. I mean, we've reached the tipping point. I mean, this is the crisis point in rural South Dakota particularly. And we can't wait until those conditions exist everywhere before we declare a constitutional violation.
What kind of evidence were you able to present that higher salaries would attract people to some of these places? I mean, it's more than just salaries, obviously. No one wants to live there.
That's part of the problem. You know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, you take a school out of a community, what family is going to move there with kids? So you have to make sure the schools are strong in order to get families to move there. But people do respond, and the state's experts admitted this. People respond to financial incentives. There are places in Rapid City and some of these other school districts where a teacher can make $17,000 more, I think was one actual example, just by moving across the border to Wyoming. Close to 40% more than they were making. And they're leaving because of financial incentives. And, you know, Wyoming's, probably eastern Wyoming's not a cup of tea to live in either. And someone who would live there would live in South Dakota. And a lot of them wanted to stay, but they can't afford to. We're dead last again, 51st in what we pay teachers. And the next up, North Dakota, is not even close. I mean, we're so far behind, it's humiliating.
So you're saying even if you were to avoid budget cuts, current proposals, there's still a constitutional violation as is today?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And that gets to me to what I'd like to talk about last, is what really are we asking this court to do? We understand that this problem cannot be solved without the cooperation of all three branches of government. We understand that the legislature ultimately is going to have to come up with a solution of some kind, or try. The short answer of what we're asking this court to do is reverse the trial court's decision and provide direction to the legislature to reverse this disastrous course. And the way to do that is to interpret Article 8 of the South Dakota Constitution and, first of all, tell the legislature what it means. They don't know. We're asking the court to enter declaratory relief holding that it establishes a minimum standard of quality for education in all school districts, not just Sioux Falls. And that it also provides, the Constitution provides a strong mandate to achieve it. There have been studies on these, on all the state constitutions, and we're at the end of the spectrum where we have one of the absolute strongest mandates to achieve and guarantee and secure an adequate education to all kids. Many states just kind of have aspirational constitutional provisions. Ours is a strong mandate. And what we're asking the court to do is set the standard at what we have detailed in our briefs, which an education will allow students to meet state-imposed academic standards and achievement requirements. Right now, the evidence is clear. In these rural districts, these focus districts, they are not able to do that.
Isn't that already mandated in the statutes?
That's right. It's mandated in the statutes that school districts do it, but school districts are not able to do it. And so the legislature has to allow them to do it, give them the ability to.
You know, normally in a declaratory judgment, if you're asking for constitutionality decision, whether or not something's constitutional, we usually have a list of statutes or a statute that is that you point to, and so that the court can actually say this statute is unconstitutional. You have a very nebulous sort of request from us, and I struggled with trying to figure out exactly what you were asking us to do, because you have not asked us to declare any statutes unconstitutional, have you?
Well,
or if you have, tell me which ones they are.
We've asked the court to declare that the system is unconstitutional.
What does that mean? I guess that, I'm still, to me, that's just, it's the system. What? And which statutes would we be looking at? The legislature has to have more direction than that.
Well, what they need to do is, it's not necessarily a statutory problem that this one statute prevents it from happening. It's the combination of all the statutes. There's so many interlocking statutes that combined, they're denying the right, the constitutional rights to the students in these districts. And so that, we think there could well be a remedial phase, and we followed a different remedial phase where the court would get to additional specific relief. But what we've done is follow what other courts have done in first giving the legislature an opportunity to fix the problem.
Isn't the remedial phase another way of saying we become the super school board for South Dakota?
Not at all, because when I say a remedial phase, it would be just to say, all right, nothing is happening, it's getting worse. Is there additional specific statutes we could look at lifting? That would be the extent of a remedial phase.
I'm trying to follow your argument on that. You want a certain amount of minimum assets to meet the educational standards. Doesn't that become a problem philosophically if you get the legislature or the departments under the direction of the legislature sets those standards? Isn't there a problem that they can lower their standards and meet a constitutional standard then? Technically, under that, all they have to do is lower their standards and they're in compliance with the Constitution. Isn't that a problem in how the statutes and the Constitution interrelate?
Well, I guess I see what you're saying. In order to get into college, for example, you're saying the state could make it let anyone get into college without meeting any minimum academic requirements or standards.
Under the remedy you just suggested, that we have to meet, that the state has to meet those standards, or it's a constitutional issue.
Well,
on the other side, if they increase the standards, then it's going to be a violation in more cases.
Well, the standards are set by the Department of Education. Those are based on research. And those are based on what other states require. What does a student need to succeed in life and succeed in college, and what is a basic minimum sound education? Those are based on generally accepted standards.
And I don't think any of us are anti-education, obviously.
Of course not.
But how do we interrelate with the Constitution and set standards that the legislature knows what we're talking about?
Well, there's a minimum standard that a high school graduate will reach. He has to be proficient in reading. He has to be proficient in math. She has to be able to be a capable citizen and voter. She has to be able to find some sort of meaning employment. He has to be able to qualify for higher education. Those are simple guidelines that we're asking this court to say a minimum education allows a child to do those things. And kids in these focus districts and rural districts and at-risk kids are not being given that opportunity.
So it's proficiency. You're saying that the constitutional yardstick is proficiency.
Proficiency. What are the opportunities and advantages of education?
Well, did you prove at trial what level of money, say, for instance, would be necessary to provide proficiency in the faith district?
We didn't say a sufficient dollar amount needed to be provided. But they have to have the evidence showed is what they needed. They need to be able to add teachers so that class sizes are down at an acceptable level. They need to be able to restore all of the basic courses that have been cut. They need to have a college preparatory program. So not only Sioux Falls kids get prepared for college, but kids in faith, if they want to, have the opportunity to be prepared for college. They need to have a facility. They need to build a school building where kids can be safe and undistracted and be able to learn. I mean, those things will cost money. I don't know how much money it'll take. And maybe the resources could be provided by a reorganization of existing funds. Maybe they could be provided by allowing the school district additional ways to raise funds. There are many ways you could solve the problem. But that doesn't mean that this court should say, because the court obviously will never be a super school board, will never get into all the details of this. That is the legislature's job. Just because this court can't do that doesn't mean that it should not say, yes, there is a constitutional requirement, and we don't think it's being met.
But at some point, I mean, I hear what you're asking for us to do today, but at some point there's going to be a step two, because if the legislature doesn't agree with the court's definition of the Constitution, or simply agrees but doesn't comply with it, you and your clients are going to be back saying, okay, now we want step two. We want you to make the legislature do what the Constitution says it has to do. I mean, that's the inevitable outcome of step one, isn't it? If the legislature doesn't comply with what you and your clients believe is the proper standard.
It's not inevitable, and of course this court need not ever get to that point. I think in the opinion of the judge's case, my time is just about up, this court made clear that just because the legislature is not living up to its constitutional duty doesn't mean that duty is then nullified or canceled. What we do is we wait. Maybe that's what we do. We wait because faces change. Sometimes minds are even changed. But the Constitution is constant.
You've gotten a lot of questions this morning, a lot of good questions. But in fairness to you, I'm going to give you 1 minute to sum up, even though your time's up.
Well,
give us your best shot.
What I would say is, you know, we come here with a great sense of urgency, and we're very reluctant applicants to the court. There's a certain carpe diem quality to these proceedings today. I mean, this is the opportunity. This is the chance to return to our first principles and our first priorities as set forth in Article 8. As Paul Newman, one of my favorite movies in The Verdict, kept reminding himself, there are no other cases. This is the case. So we don't have to wait until the ship is completely underwater before we start to bail. We don't have to wait till all the school buildings crumble and all the rural districts can't pass any kids on to college and it can't prepare any of their kids. We don't have to wait till none of them are proficient. How many more classes of kids have to flunk out of school or be not prepared before we just declare, just recognize that there's a problem?
Thank you. Very well. We will now proceed with the appellee's argument. Ms. Best, you have 45 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please support. Counsel. I, like Ron, would like to start out with talking about this issue of the court's jurisdiction. And the way we look at this issue is that there are basically four different things to look at in terms of jurisdiction. Number one, the court could rule that it entirely lacks jurisdiction, and that is the point that the state is making. The second option would be to issue what's called a pure declaratory ruling on the meaning of the Constitution alone. What do the standards mean of general and uniform and thorough and efficient? But then not look at whether the current or whether the 2008 school system met those constitutional standards, just pure declaratory ruling, which, of course, presents the issue of whether it's an advisory ruling, because it wouldn't resolve any controversy. It would be an advisory ruling. An advisory ruling under our separation of powers clauses are limited to those issues brought by the governor that the court accepts jurisdiction on for that purpose. But one thing would be a pure declaratory ruling, but it would be an advisory ruling, in at least in our opinion. And the third thing would be to issue a declaratory ruling on the meaning of the Constitution and apply it to the system as it existed at the time of trial. And, of course, that is what the trial court did. And then, of course, the fourth option would be the appellant's version that would where the court would become more involved in a remedial situation.
Well, we don't really have a choice, do we? I mean, it's our duty to interpret the Constitution. It's not some other branch of the government. The ultimate duty of interpreting our Constitution is on our shoulders.
Certainly. And there's no question that the court has authority to interpret the Constitution. It's when you get to a declaratory request like this, where they're asking you to interpret the Constitution and then say, where the only way to resolve the controversy is to say, up or down, legislature, did you appropriate enough money, or have you applied the right value judgments in handling our school system?
But in one previous case, this court only went half that distance. It said that the current statutes were unconstitutional, but then said, legislature, we now defer to you to determine the way to fix it. In other words, there was no edict to anybody from this court. It was just an interpretation that the current system didn't pass constitutional muster.
Your Honor, if you're referring to the Canale case, the Springfield school case,
I think so.
That issue involved one of the school trust funds. And in this case, there is no longer one of the school trust funds at issue as to how it's administered or whether it's appropriately funded. That's not an issue here.
I understand that, but I'm just saying we did it before, so why can't we do it again?
The court accepted jurisdiction there because it was adjudicating whether a trust fund had been violated. And in that case, the court determined that it had jurisdiction.
Well,
because it was essentially the state's trustee, and so it was not in a government political sense addressing the question, but in the sense of determining whether the trustee had operated properly, the same way the court would look at a bank trustee.
If we don't have jurisdiction to solve this issue or address it, who does?
The legislature.
Well, is there any case in our court's history where this court has simply said we don't have jurisdiction to interpret the Constitution?
The court has not been. The cases that are cited by both sides here do involve some situations where the court has said, look, we have authority to interpret the Constitution and we have authority to resolve the matter. In this particular case is unique in that they're asking for an interpretation of the Constitution and they're asking for up or down. Do we have enough funding or don't we? Well, how much funding is a core legislative function? And they said, well, we're not really asking you to appropriate. Well, you're asking to send it back to the legislature, fix it, then come back and say up or down, is it okay now? And then another revolving door situation, is it okay now? They're asking you folks to be the veto power over the legislature.
There's a flip side to that analogy, though. What happens if the legislature cuts state aid to education in half? Still no jurisdiction here?
Your Honor, I would submit that there's still no jurisdiction here.
Okay, you know what's coming. What if they wipe it out completely?
Right.
No jurisdiction. They're just, school districts are out of luck.
Your Honor, I believe that issue was addressed a similar issue was addressed in 1895 by one of the early state Supreme Court. And in fact, in 1895, at that time, two of the actual constitutional framers were on the bench. In that case is In re State Census. And In re State Census, the court said there are certain items in the Constitution that are self-executing. There are certain items that prohibit conduct, and we certainly have the authority to rule on prohibitions. And then there are certain items. The third class is embraces provisions requiring the legislature to enact certain law but prescribes no penalty for a failure to perform the duty. There is no power to compel the legislative department to enact laws. Responsibility to their constituents and a sense of public duty are the only incentives that can prompt legislative action under this class of constitutional provisions.
Well, and of course, in that case, if I remember correctly, they still declared that the action of the legislature was inappropriate and declared it to be a continuing violation, did they not?
What the court said is that we can't tell the legislature that it has to conduct a census this year.
You have to conduct a census. It's a violation not to.
It just said there's a constitutional provision requiring conducting a census. And, Governor, we're not going to let the legislature out from under it because that's what was requested.
So what you're telling me, if they choose to violate the Constitution, they're able to do that?
Well, they're politically. They're elected officials.
Yes.
And they haven't abrogated their authority yet.
That is the question, whether they have or not, isn't it?
Well, the trial court found that they had not abrogated their authority, and you know I'll get into that too. But our point is
that a factual issue or is that a legal issue? Because we review them differently.
Well, there are some legal issues, certainly, that the trial court was called on to resolve. For example, it's a legal issue as to whether something is a fundamental right. In large part, this whole issue of whether there is sufficient funding to run the school systems and whether the progress that we've seen by our students and the proficiency we've seen by our students directly correlates to funding. Those are all factual questions.
Let me ask you this on to the next, if we get past this first issue that you're trying to present to the court. What if we get past that and decide that we obviously have jurisdiction? What I heard this morning is that probably the state and the appellants in this case really don't disagree a whole lot on what type of an education the Constitution requires. Is that, did I hear that correctly? And I know there was a lot of discussion on whether it should be quality or adequate. I heard adequate this morning. So that may be not an issue. Is that correct?
Well,
I mean, you said we should, you know, we could, if we jump to the next stage, we determine what do the words of the Constitution mean as far as meeting the constitutional threshold for adequate education. How do we do that?
Well, Your Honor, I think there is a difference of opinion between the parties as far as what that actual standard is. The words in the Constitution are that to establish a general and uniform system and to make provision by general taxation and authorize school corporations to levy taxes for a thorough and efficient system. Those are the words. And so you have the four words in the Constitution, some of which are somewhat at tension with one another. Efficiency, perhaps at tension with some of the other provisions. But certainly those four words were interpreted by the Sixth Circuit trial court in the Bezdacek case to mean that that's an adequate basic education.
All right. Constitution goes on, though, and talks about the security of the people, the advantages and opportunities of education.
Right.
Doesn't that mean something? You didn't say that the Constitution says it. It has to mean something.
Oh, certainly. I wasn't intending to leave that out.
Okay, well, isn't that the provision we're talking about?
Well, my point here is that what was asked is whether we agree with the qualitative standards that the appellants have raised. That the provision that adequate means quality. So we've gone from general and uniform, thorough and efficient, to adequate in the Bezdacek case, and now the appellants are saying, well, adequate means quality.
Now that case never got to this court.
It did not. And then appellants further say, well, adequate means quality, and let's take a look at that. That means being able to be meaningfully employed. Well, that's an equally subjective standard, obviously. What is meaningful employment? Well, that's in the eyes of the beholder. Some would say, you know, that being a lawyer isn't meaningful employment.
Well, obviously we know it's that's what they intended when they set up the school districts originally. Must have meant it for something. Reading, writing, and employment and the ability to be good citizens, right? So you have to be able to read and write and participate in government. Wasn't that their objective? So what does that mean today, in today's world? Isn't that the question that really is before?
Well,
in part of this
Certainly, we would submit that that standard would be a basic education, one that allows students to function in today's modern society and either to go on to some additional school, whether it's Votech or college, or else to find employment in today's market. That's what it means.
So isn't there a problem then when you have a school district where 50% of the students are not proficient in reading?
Well,
I mean, wouldn't 50% kind of take your breath away a little bit if 50% of our citizenry couldn't read in today's times?
Well, I want to get to that because I think that what was stated here this morning by the appellants is that a number of students are not, and they gave a certain number, are not proficient in basic math or proficient in basic reading. And I want to make it very clear to the court that some of these standards mean proficiency as measured under the No Child Left Behind Act. And so when we're talking about proficient in 11th grade for reading, we're not saying that they can't read. We're saying it's on today's test for 11th grade that they don't meet the high standard in the NCLB for proficiency. It's not that they can't read at all and that they won't do well in society once they graduate. Now, obviously, the system is set up to try and make sure that these students do well in reading and that they gain proficiency. And the whole point of NCLB is to identify those students that are not proficient and to figure out ways to work with those students and to help them gain that proficiency.
Well, you're not saying that no child is irrelevant, are you? I mean, it's certainly some evidence of a current standard.
It's not irrelevant, but it's not the constitutional standard.
Okay.
It's a goal, and it's like a lot of public policy. You have the base goal. What is our goal? You know, ability to complete high school, function in modern society. And then you have aspirational standards that are goals. And maybe, you know, those goals should be NCLB goals or some other goal that Congress is going to set next year.
So your definition of constitutional standard is proficient in reading, writing, complete high school, and prepare for job market. Is that what you say?
It's job market or go on to
higher education. And you're accepting that that's a basic constitutional requirement?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, I wanted to get back to, and I'm prepared to talk about some of these facts. A number of them, you know, obviously are fully addressed in these lengthy briefs. But I wanted to get back to one thing that happened this morning during appellant's argument, and that is this issue of their concession that there are schools in South Dakota that provide adequate education. Their claim in this case is that there's a systemic failure and that we've got, and basically that there's a facial, they're claiming that that's a facial challenge to the current school system. And the standard, of course, for a facial challenge is that there's no version where the system or the statute could possibly survive, that there's no interpretation where it's constitutional, no interpretation where it can't be violated. Well, we've got an interpretation where it's constitutional. Appellants admitted that schools can constitutionally can meet the constitutional standard.
But Ms. Bass, I got to interrupt you right there because they're very clear in their briefs that they're also mounting a as-applied challenge.
That's right. So I would submit that they have not met their standard in the facial challenge. You get to the as-applied challenge. I want to point out that the plaintiffs in this case are parents and students from two school districts, Bonham and Florence.
But why can't they do as-applied to Faith and Bonham and the other districts?
Well, they haven't made out a case that they are trying to represent other students. They've indicated in their briefing that they are not representing school districts. They're not representing any school districts.
But they're sitting.
They're not handling this in a representative capacity.
They may not be, but they're setting forth factual situations that they claim demonstrate inadequacy. Isn't that the essence of a as-applied challenge? They set forth the facts in Bonham and Faith, etc., and they say that's not adequate. That's a legitimate as-applied challenge.
Well, the facts as to Bonham and Florence are the only schools that the as-applied challenge would.
But I'm understanding.
And the facts there demonstrate that they're very good.
I'm understanding what I, you know, maybe I'm off, but my understanding from the argument in the briefs is that if there are that big of holes in the, and I'm putting it in my own words here, there are that big of holes in the system that students can fall through the cracks and not get an adequate education, there's a problem with the system systemically. But they are not getting an adequate education. And I think that's the argument. So they're not necessarily in a representative capacity, but if you set up a system and it isn't doing the job it's supposed to be doing or the job that the Constitution requires and a significant number of students aren't getting the constitutional guarantees, then that's the problem. That's how I understand it.
Well, I would submit that is basically what their facial challenge amounts to, and I think they've conceded that this morning. And when it gets to their as-applied challenge, you're looking at Florence and Bonham, where you have the Bonham superintendent say, we provide excellent education. You have Jim Putnam, who has lived down there a considerable number of years, and sends his granddaughter goes to school. It's an excellent school. The evidence is all good regarding the basic quality of the Bonham School. There was testimony for a full day on the Bonham School. And the court found, as a matter of fact, that it meets the constitutional standards. Same with Florence. The worst the superintendent could say in Florence regarding the Florence School was some of our students don't get an adequate education. What some students? Is it these plaintiffs or isn't it? No evidence. They just haven't met their as-applied burden with respect to these students. And I want to talk about this issue of good schools. And the court looked at a considerable number of facts. They're not clearly erroneous. The court made the credibility determinations on these superintendents, and she made them for a reason. The superintendents, some of them, obviously not the Bonham one, but some of them were coming to court and saying, we can't provide an adequate education. And in the case of the Bonham one, we're on the verge of not being able to provide an adequate education. And at the same time, these same superintendents had articles in the newspaper, great school they had. They made admissions in court as to the positive things that were going on in their schools. And they filed grant applications seeking federal money, which were signed under penalty of perjury, that said, we've got a good school, we have a good recruiting system for teachers, and yet they were coming to court and poor-mouthing the schools. Well, they're inherently biased. They're the guys looking for money for their schools. We get that, but that doesn't mean that they were credible witnesses. And the court found that, indeed, were not credible witnesses. So that's what that's all about.
Is that a little concerning to you that the court, if I understand correctly, the court found that every one of the superintendents who testified on behalf of the plaintiffs were not credible. Is that worrisome to you, that all these people, these superintendents, are not credible?
Well, there were five that were found not to be credible. In the case of Rapid City, it was a former school board member that didn't even purport really to be an expert witness, and I think he was disgruntled about some other things that had happened in the Rapid City School District. But in terms of those five superintendents, the evidence clearly demonstrated that they were not credible witnesses to the extent they were saying, look, we're not providing an adequate education, but yet they're telling the community and they're telling the federal government something else.
Isn't that more a question of just putting your best foot forward? I mean, you are trying to portray confidence in the system that you're running and recruit good teachers. You're not going to recruit good teachers by saying, come to my school district, we stink. On the other hand, there's always room for improvement. And candidly, maybe when they came into the courtroom in front of Judge Wilbur, they're saying, overall, maybe not too bad, but here are our problems. They're significant. They're real. Isn't it more of a weighing process than just saying, well, you're credible or you're not?
They actually didn't say, overall, not too bad to the court. They just engaged in this poor-mouthing deal. And the court found, based, each of them testified about a day and went through the ins and outs of the school facilities, the student progress, and various other factors, and the court found after trial that each one of them had the same problem. So I would submit that the court's finding in that regard is not clearly erroneous. And I would also point out that the court made additional findings regarding the good school achievement that we have. And this issue about achievement is,
if that, some of that's half, the glass is half full or the glass is half empty, isn't it? I mean, it's 75%, you know, you might argue 75% do, you know, proficient. I don't remember the statistics, but you argue the 75%, the other side says the 25% isn't good enough.
Sure.
And so a lot of the actual, you know, all this credibility stuff, perhaps the trial courts have gone too much into, as soon as they use that word, then we're going to uphold them. But really the basic facts here are not in dispute, because it's the conclusions. I mean, the statistics speak for themselves. The graduation rates speak for themselves. All those rates, those must be statistics that are provided by the Department of Education and other people that aren't in dispute. So it's just a matter of taking them, and is that enough or isn't it enough? And isn't a lot of that just an argument?
Some of each, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. There are some matters that aren't in dispute. How many kids go to a school, what they're paying for special ed, what they're paying for general funds.
And how many aren't in dispute. And the amount that's spent per student.
Sure. Right.
And the success rate, graduation rates, all those kinds of things. Right, remedial courses, all those things. I mean, those are statistics that.
Well, there are a number of matters that actually are in dispute. The appellants are saying students are going to school in dilapidated buildings. Dr. Melmer looked at those buildings. The expert for the state, Dr. Murphy, looked at those buildings, and also the superintendents on cross examination. Conceded to a certain extent on the buildings. So the condition of the buildings, this issue of whether we have poor teachers or not, the appellants are the ones, I mean, they're actually filing a brief paid for by school districts that says that teachers are poor teachers. That's very offensive, and it is not a reflection of what happened in court.
Well, I don't want to get into facts. We don't have a witness chair, and we don't deal with facts other than what's in the record. We do deal with the Constitution. And you've stated today, and you accept, that it's a constitutional responsibility to provide a basic education. Now, if the legislature is not providing adequate, how do we define that? What's your solution for saying, well, maybe not this district, maybe not that district, but if there are districts that are not providing basic education, isn't that a problem under the Constitution?
Well, we'd certainly submit, Your Honor, as you're aware, that the districts in South Dakota are absolutely providing a constitutional education.
So it's your position
education.
That they every district in the state, every student is receiving the type of education that meets the Constitution?
The students are being provided with an opportunity to receive a constitutionally sufficient education. There are students that who are not taking advantage of that. There are factors that that affect student achievement beyond what's happening in the classroom.
But the Constitution says to secure advantages and opportunities. What does that mean?
To secure opportunities. To secure advantages and opportunities.
But doesn't that mean that the outputs need to be there?
Well, there isn't a system that can guarantee that a student will be motivated to come to school. The schools develop plans, and the State Department of Education develops plans to figure out ways that give students incentives to get to school. And, of course, we have truancy laws. But bottom line is students have to be motivated to come there, and they have to be motivated to graduate, and we have excellent attendance and graduation rates. Ours are at the top of the country. Okay, now you get to the issue of student performance. We have excellent student performance. We actually do achieve at excellent levels. Our ACT levels are right up there. We're basically, our state since the state institutions require ACT, we're one of the states that is one of the higher number of percentage of takers of ACT, and usually the higher percentage takers of ACT, you'll find that they'll have the lower ACT scores because you have so many that are taking it, it'll bring the scores down. It's not the case in South Dakota. We actually are one of the top ones in the country in terms of ACT scores. We have less turnover than average in the country on teachers. We're 10th in the nation, I guess, in graduation rate. I said we were one of the top ones. We have experts that came in that looked at measures of student performance, whether it's the national assessment, which is a survey that's taken among some of the schools in the state, whether it's the proficiency test, the Dakota STEP test that's professionally developed and adopted and approved by the United States Department of Education, whether it's this ACT, and then they also looked at the core requirements that are required by the state in math, science, fine arts, personal finance, computer studies, and foreign language. And these experts looked at these measures in various ways and were clearly able to testify that we're at the top of the country in terms of student success. Well, one of the things brought up today was, well, gee, we've got kids that are going to college and they're having to take remedial courses. And, you know, I heard that too and going through this trial, and I thought, what? Well, it turns out that if you look at that number alone, you think it says something? What it says is that a student may not take a course in high school in biology thinking that they're not going to go to college or whatever. And then they change their mind, they go to college, they take the remedial course. It's that sort of thing. And that's consistent with what's happening around the country. The remedial course level that we have is about the same as what's happening in other states. That's what the record shows. The proficiency issue that you have is by and large, among these disadvantaged students, where we have the high poverty, we have factors that that can't be controlled for, like parenting, peers, overall cultural issues, and that doesn't mean that the state is not working on those issues. They have to be handled. And we had experts look at that, too. And they have to be handled.
Did experts say you can fix all that?
Well, I don't think we had it. You know, I heard that this morning, too, that we had an expert that could handle it all in 2 years. I didn't hear any experts say that at trial, and I was there.
I think I actually read that in the transcript, though. So when your expert said something like, give it to me, I could figure out how to fix this. And I think he was talking about the Rapid City School District, my recollection.
Well, and it was the witness for the state, Murphy. What he actually said is he had actually been involved in the Charlotte Mecklenburg School and some of those racial integration issues. And on individual school basis, he said he could turn them around and he can turn them around fairly quickly. When you get to a statewide basis, he testified that it would take considerably longer. And one of the issues with these students is you may have a cultural issue in one area of the state, and the issue may be different in another area of the state.
Out of whack does it have to get in order for it to? I mean, would it never be unconstitutional? I mean, let's say that we don't, the western part of the state or the middle part of the state that's emptying out, you have these small schools and so much distance in between that you can't consolidate and all that. And these kids are just not getting comparable at all to any place else east of the river or even Rapid City, say. Isn't there at some point those children have a constitutional right to be educated in the state of South Dakota? And where does it have to get to? I mean, you can't just look at overall statistics. Don't you have to look at pockets of areas where if these kids are not getting an adequate education and the system is not providing them, doesn't there have to come a time where the courts can say, this is unconstitutional because these kids are not getting the education the Constitution requires?
Well, at trial in this case in 2008, based on 2008 information that the appellants brought to trial, they brought in 6 focus districts. Now, it was up to them to present the evidence, and they didn't meet that burden of proof. They didn't show that there was a systemic problem. They didn't show that achievement problems among these groups are solvable or correlate to the lack of funding. And when you don't have this cause and effect, how do you get there? How can you say the Constitution's been violated because we don't spend enough money, or the Constitution's been violated because the state legislature isn't doing its job, when they can't prove to the court that there's a correlation between the results of those students, the ones you're talking about with proficiency problems, and funding? And they can't show it, and of course they can't show it because that correlation isn't there. And of course, you referred to it, Your Honor, earlier, I think, too, that we have schools, $12,000 a student. It's in the state's appendix that shows a couple different things of graphs that show that we've got $12,000, $20,000 a student in some of these schools, and yet those are the schools with proficiency problems. We know where the problem is. We know where the issue is with those students. The Department of Education testified they have people working on it. They're trying to figure out ways to get Native Americans educated in being administrators, because in some schools that's been understood to be something that could be successful. We've got a program in place working on that. There are things that are happening in the education community, and it's in the trial record with regard to that.
They're
not a systemic problem.
Though, actually, the Department of Education and probably the legislators as well, they would all say there's not enough funding, probably.
Well,
when does it become? I don't think anybody's saying there's necessarily this is the amount that should be provided to education. But, where does it get to the point it becomes constitutional?
Well, that's not enough funding deal. It's a political issue. I'm not here to say it.
The Department of Education over the years has always advocated for more funding for the local school districts.
The Department of Education, it's an issue that that is before the legislature, whether it's the Department of Education or the various associations, and, you know, I'm not saying that the legislature shouldn't appropriate more money. I'm not going to go to the AG's office, isn't going to go to the legislature and tell them not to appropriate more money. We don't want to do that. But that doesn't make it any different that the burden of proof has not been met in this case.
One of the troubling aspects of this case for me is the fact that the funding formula that the legislature has adopted is not related to the actual cost of educating students. Why not, and why shouldn't that be a standard, that the actual cost be a consideration?
What happened was there was a funding formula that was held to be constitutional by the circuit court in 1997 in the Vestachek case. And there was an overall amount of money at that time that was being appropriated. And at that time, we were looking at cost base and then so much categorical money for buses and so much categorical money for these other programs. And the legislature decided to go ahead and look at what that total amount of money was. But instead of going with how much it costs, because of course school district, it's like building a house on a turnkey type situation. The more you build, the more you pay, and you know, the more you turn over to somebody else, the more you pay. So they went they took the total sum that was being spent then, which was cost-based, and then divided it up on a per-pupil basis. And since then, they went ahead and went with an index factor and then gave a cost.
So now we have a formula that doesn't relate to costs.
Well, we have a formula that relates to what the costs were, and then we have an index that increases that amount per pupil. And then we have now started to see those adjustments come back in again for school districts with large school districts with sparse population like Faith, or school districts that are growing a great deal, like the ones around Sioux Falls. They'll get a growing school adjustment to sort of catch up money.
Of course, the plaintiffs contend the index factors aren't adequate.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, we would submit that that's a political question. Should there be a new funding mechanism every year? But they could go ahead and just appropriate a new sum every year. But they've put an index factor into the statute. They're not bound by that index factor under APA. You know, the legislature can go back and redo it.
Did any expert on either side ever testify at trial as to what amount of money is necessary to provide an adequate education?
The state's school fiscal person, we had two of them that testified, Tamara Darnell and Susan Woodmansey. They testified as to what the current revenue is and what's being spent, what the reserves are by the school district. And then other witnesses testified that the current system is adequate. So that's what the testimony amounted to. There was not some sort of what it costs to run a school study, because, appellants actually had one, but they dropped it before trial. So, and there were obviously some issues with that, and so we didn't put in evidence to counter that because they had dropped it. So.
What about the cap? Isn't there a problem placing a cap on the local taxes? I mean, that's been in existence now.
Are you talking about the property tax freeze and the opt-out?
I mean, if part of the system is relying on property taxes and the opt-outs and all that, and then making it so draconian to raise local taxes beyond a certain level, doesn't that create some problems with this system?
Well, what we were seeing at trial is that it wasn't the school schools that they chose, which we have to assume are the worst-case scenario in terms of funding. Schools that they chose were either not levying the full amount under the general funds or not levying the full amount under the
without
capital outlay funds. And that's not true of all of them, but some of them weren't.
Do you know if there's anything in the record that tells that there is a statistic of how many schools are at the maximum without and would have to opt out?
There are charts in the record. And I don't have the exact exhibit number, but it's in the 2500s, like 2517 or 2518, 2520, that would show what the reserves are for the school districts. And so the ones that wouldn't, that don't have money in reserves would probably be the ones that would maybe make that claim. But that's as close as evidence as there would be.
The question is, you know, what's the maximum that they can, I mean, whatever that is, that in order to get, I can't remember what it is now, that they can tax without having to opt out. The ceiling, what is it?
You're talking about for state general funds?
Yes. Well, I'm talking about local property taxes. How much can they levy locally?
Well, there's the capital outlay levy. I'd have to look here.
Okay. What I'm looking at is, do we know, let's say 100% or 99% of the schools are maximum, are taxing their local citizens and property taxes to the maximum, and they can't go any higher. Is that, I mean, what do we know what percentage of schools are really doing their local effort to the maximum?
I don't have that number for you, Your Honor.
Okay, we know how many have opted out. That's in the record, isn't it?
It's in the record that there's a number that have opted out, yes. I wanted to, in the short amount of time I have left, is to clear up a couple things, I think, about this new evidence that came in this morning. Mr. Parsons said that South Dakota spends the lowest per pupil in the nation. I'm not recalling that in the record, but there's certainly, I can tell you right here and now, there were certainly no findings proposed in that regard by the appellants. I did just check on that. There were allegations regarding 2010 test results. You know, I don't think it's fair that they brought those 2010 test results in, but I'm not embarrassed about them. They are what they are. But to say that that means they're not proficient in basic math makes it sound like these 11th graders don't have third grade skills, and that's just not what that NCLB standard means. They've talked about, they talked about some new things that happened, and I have to tell you, Your Honor, I have to tell the court this. There were allegations made today about school buildings in Faith, and it's not in the record, but the Faith voters voted in a $3.3 million bond, or at least that's what they reported to the South Dakota Department of Education. And that school building that he's talking about has already been demolished. Now, I'm not here to tell you that those trailers, the so-called trailers, which are buildings built for school systems to bring in when in circumstances like this, I'm not here to tell you they're a bad thing. They're actually well-constructed. They were constructed for that purpose. They've been in the buildings for a period of years. They work fine. But Faith wants to build a new school building, and that's fine, and it's gone ahead and done that. So I felt, in all honesty, that the court needed to know that actually has happened.
Like your time has expired, and like Mr. Parsons, I'll give you 1 minute to sum up.
The jurisdiction issue is laid out in the briefs. There are four different avenues the court could take. I think you're very well acquainted with what position the state's taking, what position the court took, or the trial court took, and what position the appellants took. So I won't go into that. I would submit that there is a serious issue on this admission this morning on the facial challenge, and that we're down to the Bonham and Florence school districts. And those are the only two that are involved here if we're talking about these plaintiffs. And then when we get to the standard, the standards, the basic standard, ability to function in modern society, go on to college or VOTAC or get a job. Yes, that's the standard that we've talked about. The other point is, appellants have not met their burden of showing that there is a problem with today's or the 2008 funding system that causes low achievement in schools. Those two things, they have never said, they've never shown a correlation there. And their answer to that is, we don't have to show it. It's in their brief. Well, just look at the achievement. You don't even have to look at what the inputs are. And you see poor achievement, you need to do something about it. Well, what? They're asking for money, but money for what? How can you get that burden of proof there? They failed to present their, to bring their burden of proof, and there are many factual determinations that the trial court made, and we would submit that they were not clearly erroneous. If the court gets to facts,
you got about a minute and a half out of me. So.
if the court gets to facts, I would urge affirmance. Obviously, we would ask the jurisdiction determination. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bess. Mr. Parsons, you have 15 minutes, sir.
Start with the causation issue. That is troublesome. It was. I had a hard time grappling with that as well. So maybe you could address that.
I'd love to, Your Honor. I think the best evidence comes from the admissions by the state's own witnesses on that. The state's witnesses and all of the superintendents obviously testified that more resources will build schools that have been lost. More resources will add courses that can't be provided. And more resources will provide a college preparatory program that the state's admitted is essential to prepare kids to succeed in college. More resources will reduce class sizes.
Aren't all those inputs?
Those are all inputs, and the admissions by the state demonstrated and admitted that those types of inputs have an effect on kids. They admitted that teachers, the quality of the teacher is the single most important thing in the classroom that will improve student performance. And they admitted, however, that many of these districts cannot attract or maintain teachers that are even qualified. They admitted that there's a minimum level of funding. Now, Dr. Murphy admitted, there's on page 3521, there must be an adequate level of funding to support an adequate school, that the lack of funding results in deteriorating facilities and services, and that school districts vary in the amount of funding that they require. And Eric Hanushek, their other star witness, admitted, and I believe it starts on page 2633 and continues, that additional resources can positively affect outputs and that teacher quality is critical and improves performance. Now, his main point that he was brought there to say is that how you spend money is more important than the fact or the amount of money that you spend. But that's a truism. Of course that's true.
But Secretary Milner, I have his transcript here. When he was the Secretary of Education at the time, he sees no correlation between the funding of schools to achievement.
But we know that's not true. I mean, we know there is at least a minimum level of funding.
I mean, this is our top educator. He's now running the School of Education at the university, and he says this.
And he says that.
Say that doesn't. He's not right on it.
Well, I think the state's experts disagreed with that. That there is a correlation between resources and services, and services obviously affect outcomes. I mean, it's true. Just look at the school districts like Sioux Falls that do have resources. They have much higher proficiency levels, and the districts that have no resources, that have very limited resources, have abysmal proficiency levels. And here's the other thing, they've gone down. I mean, it's been dropping ever since the funding formula has been changed. I mean, we're seeing worse and worse and worse in these districts that are underfunded, that are clearly underfunded, that have been skeletonized and cannibalized.
You know, we can look at various examples like that, but I see the trial court made a finding of fact that there was no statistically relevant correlation shown, or no statistically significant, I think it was. correlation proven at trial, at least according to the experts she believed.
And I just think I that's clearly erroneous. I don't understand how you can say that given the other testimony, that resources that provide teachers and provide course offerings that we know work, that those actually improve student performance, that if you do, if you provide those resources, however you do it, that that won't have an effect on kids' performances. And the other thing I really want to stress in this record is that we have this body of information about at-risk kids. And those are the at-risk kids are the ones that are falling through the cracks. And now, you know, it's a substantial portion of our population. And they're in these rural districts, and they're in Native American populated districts.
Yet some of those districts are the highest funded per student.
Some of them are.
How do you answer that?
Well, and they get federal funding, and some of them are the highest funded, but that doesn't mean that they're adequately funded. But the point I wanted to make was that because it depends on the district for what their needs are. You know, Sioux Falls has a massive budget, much larger than any of these smaller communities. So doing a per pupil analysis, I think, isn't the most accurate way to do it. But we know, and Secretary Melner, for example, on pre-K, he's testified and admitted, the research is absolutely clear that for at-risk kids, kids who come to school unprepared because they're socially disadvantaged, they have a vocabulary that's one-fifth of what a privileged child or a normally stationed child would have. Pre-K, which we're one of the few states in the nation that doesn't have pre-K absolutely helps these children catch up. So these at-risk kids who enter the school door totally unprepared, they're entitled to the same advantages and opportunities of education. They're entitled for it to be secured.
Parsons, I'm going to paraphrase the state a little bit. Ms. Best said, all you're asking us to do is order more money. That's paraphrasing it a little bit. I'm giving you an opportunity again to say what you're asking us to do.
We've said from the beginning, we're not asking this court to order a dollar to be spent. Only the legislature can do that. What we're asking this court to do is to interpret the Constitution and tell us what it means. Give us a standard, as we've detailed in our briefs, that's been adopted by most courts in the country that provides what an adequate education is. Declare that there's a systematic problem that's evidenced by all these districts, not every district, but all the districts, the focus districts, the rural districts, the districts with all these at-risk kids, where it's proven. Two-thirds of the kids in a district are not proficient in reading or math. It's proven, undeniable, they don't have a college preparatory class. So a Sioux Falls kid can be prepared, and it's needed, it's admitted, to succeed in college. Sioux Falls kids can get that and go to college. You can't say only Sioux Falls kids have that opportunity, but kids in Faith and Bonham and in rural country counties don't. So set the standard, and then order the legislature to correct it. Just what the court did in the Canale case. Found a constitutional violation, said it should be corrected, declared it, and said, but it's up to the legislature, of course, and it's a political activity to determine how that should be done. And legislature should study this problem. I mean, when there was a problem with a railroad that was going to go bankrupt and be lost, and we're going to, in I think it was the 1970s when Governor Janklow, I think his first term, agriculture was going to be decimated by the loss of this railroad. So he called special sessions of the legislature and said, I'm going to keep you in session until we come up with a solution. At least he tried. I mean, there was an effort. And so this court should instruct the legislature, here's a problem, we've identified it, apply the constitutional standard to the facts and say, correct it, that's your job. Now, I understand the legislature says, no, we're not going to do that. We don't care about the Constitution. We don't have the money. I'm sorry. We need them to step forward and come up with a creative solution to study this, but they're going to have to do that. But to say we don't think they will doesn't mean that this court should say, well, then we're just going to pretend that there's not a violation of the Constitution. We have to at least identify the problem before we can ever begin to work on it. And we're not trying to shift blame. I mean, the legislature, of course, cares about kids all across the state. To many degrees, to a great sense, their hands are tied. But other states have come up with solutions to this when they've gone through the exact same process. That's the beauty of the checking of power with power that our constitutional provision sets up, our system sets up. The judiciary has a role to play in this, to declare and interpret and enforce the Constitution. The courts are not potted plants in this process. But we do. We need the legislature to be creative and come up with a solution. That's ultimately where a creative solution that either reorganizes resources somehow, comes up with different priorities, increases resources, that is their job. And that's what we need to at least ask them to do. Unless the court has additional questions, I think I'm very grateful for the extra time that we've been given, the extra room in our briefs. I want to just thank the state, Attorney General Jackley and Attorney General Long, Ms. Best and Ms. Rank. They've been nothing but professional to work with. I mean, we do things well in South Dakota. We work together cooperatively. And I want to thank the trial judge who gave it her best effort. And I know that this important issue will have your full attention, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. The court will be in recess.